and demands rather than engage in real negotiations. Arafat also denied reports about contacts with U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff or Secretary of State Marco Rubio. The top diplomat stressed that as long as Americans are not ready for real negotiations, Iran is in no hurry for talks, answering a question on any possible future Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear sites. Arafat said there is no logic in repeating an operation that has already been attempted and failed, as it would only end in failure again. Investigative journalist Tony Gossing joined us earlier to discuss the likelihood of Iran and the U.S. resuming nuclear negotiations. Let's hear more.
And it may be simply that Witkoff is being told to concentrate on Russia, but they will say that they're doing X, Y, and Z in the Middle East with the Israelis, with Iran and other countries, whereas actually their minions are being sent there, I suppose, small diplomats, people who just do as they're told, but they've got no real power, in order to make it look as an illusion of some kind of diplomatic efforts going on. So it's very difficult to know exactly what's going on, because there's so much subterfuge coming out of the West, which does imply, doesn't it, that they are cooking up something, particularly in the Middle East. So what they're doing, I think, with these sorts of strikes, and of course a decapitation, it may be a more full-scale attack, these sorts of attacks are just designed to destabilise, and in many ways they show more about the moral bankruptcy and the lack of military and financial strategy in the West than they do about those who are actually being assassinated. It's saying much more about those doing the assassinating and how frightened in some ways or destabilized or unstable they are.
Iran's top security official Ali Larijani has wrapped up a two-day visit to Pakistan, marked by high-level talks on Gaza regional tensions, border security, counter-terror cooperation, and economic ties, reflecting a renewed resolve by both nations to tackle shared regional challenges together. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi brings us more in this report.
Yet another busy day for Iran's top security official in Pakistan, marked by intense diplomatic engagements, strategic consultations, and rare interactions with both Pakistani and Iranian media. Speaking to reporters earlier on Wednesday, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council Ali Larijani addressed the rapidly changing security landscape of the region. He noted that both Pakistan and Iran had played an important role in supporting the Palestinian cause, condemning the Israeli aggression and calling for an immediate halt to what he described as systematic oppression of civilians.
When it comes to defending the people of Palestine, Iran and Pakistan act in the same direction, each playing their part. Despite some troublemakers, we believe Pakistan can play a positive role in supporting regional stability and Palestinian rights.
Larijani also met religious scholars, clerics, and influential political figures of Pakistan. The discussion focused on interfaith harmony, sectarian unity, and the role of religious leadership in countering extremism across the region.
Our two-day visit provided an important opportunity to meet Pakistan's top leadership to discuss economic, security, and regional issues. We agreed to strengthen cooperation to counter terrorism and prevent destabilizing activities along our shared border. We explored ways to expand trade, including key goods, banking relations, and investments, with a goal of raising bilateral trade to $10 billion. Infrastructure projects like the Islamabad-Zahedan Railway Corridor and its link to the North-South Corridor were also discussed for mutual investment.
Pakistan's political leaders acknowledge Iran's important role in the region, stating that Iran has the right to develop its nuclear program for peaceful purposes.
Iran is a country which stood against the nuclear powers, you know. And I feel that it's the right of every nation to have a nuclear facility for peaceful purposes. And Iran has oftenly said that they have no intention for nuclear weapons. They want a nuclear for their peaceful purposes.
The visit's key moment came at General Headquarters, where Larijani met Pakistan's top military commander, Field Marshal Asim Munir, and senior security officials to discuss strengthening defense ties, enhancing cross-border security, coordinating counterterrorism efforts, and expanding intelligence cooperation.
With shared concerns over developments in West Asia and the wider region, Tehran and Islamabad appear committed to shaping a coordinated response that protects their national interest and supports regional stability. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
Hamas has strongly condemned Israel's pursuit, killing, and arrest of its besieged fighters in the tunnels of Rafah in southern Gaza, calling it a brutal crime. Hamas said the regime's move also constitutes a flagrant violation of the Gaza ceasefire agreement. The movement added that Israel's killing of besieged fighters in Rafah proves that the regime is trying to undermine the truce agreement. Hamas said it has made every effort during past months through mediators to resolve the issue of the besieged fighters and facilitate their return to their homes. However, it added that the Israeli regime has sabotaged all those efforts, choosing to kill and abduct the fighters and undermine the mediator's best efforts to solve this problem. Hamas held Israel fully responsible for the lives of its fighters in Rafah, urging the ceasefire mediators to pressure the regime to allow them to return to their homes. Our Gaza correspondent, Moti Abu Mossabeh, joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israel's ceasefire violations across the war-torn territory. Let's take a listen.
According to the last update of the Gaza health minister, that at least five Palestinian civilians were killed today as a result of those constant attacks. The last two were killed in Beit Lahia city in the northern Gaza Strip after the Israeli fighter drones attacked a group of the Palestinian people in that area. Meanwhile, the Israeli attacks are still persistent against the eastern side of Khan Yunis city, whereas over the past couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces intensified their mass shooting towards those areas. Needless to mention that the Israeli artillery strikes are still ongoing also against various spots of Gaza, basically against the eastern side of Gaza City and the eastern side of the central area of Gaza Strip as well. So the Israeli regime is still escalating and ramping up its attacks against the Palestinian people, and those attacks are nothing short of flagrant violations of the ceasefire agreement. So this is a systematic policy, as you know, maintained by the Israeli regime against the Palestinian people here in Gaza in order to keep the Palestinian people living the same sentiment and the same atmosphere they used to live during the genocide war. So for the Palestinian people, from this perspective, nothing has been significantly changed. They are still experiencing more bombings, more attacks, more mass shooting, more mass killing of their beloved ones.
The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that thousands of internally displaced people in Gaza are still struggling to find safe shelter as the cold weather approaches. According to UNRWA, the displaced people of Gaza have no option but to erect makeshift tents amid increasing attacks and ceasefire violations by Israeli forces. The agency noted that more than 79,000 displaced people are living in 85 UNRWA-run shelters in Gaza amid increasingly dire humanitarian conditions as winter approaches. The warning came after the UN chief spokesperson said displaced Palestinian families in Gaza are facing the risk of flooding in their inadequate shelters. Stefan Dujarric warned that these families are extremely vulnerable due to severe weather conditions. Palestinian sources say Gaza needs approximately 300,000 tents and prefabricated housing units to meet the most basic shelter needs of its residents after Israel destroyed much of the territory's infrastructure during its genocide. The Israeli regime has launched yet another military operation, this time in the occupied West Bank city of Tubas. The Israeli military leadership has described the operation as preemptive, citing a usual pretext of a terrorist threat. According to Hebrew media reports, Israeli forces have laid siege to Tubas and its surrounding areas by imposing a curfew there. Our correspondent Tibasi tells us more from the city of Jenin.
Under the pretext of pursuing wanted individuals, Israeli forces, accompanied by the internal spy agency, Shin Bet, and police, have launched an operation in the occupied West Bank city of Tubas, bringing the entire region to a standstill. They began raids by closing all entrances to the governorate and imposing a curfew from its northern areas down to the northern Jordan Valley, effectively paralyzing the movement of residents.
Since 4 a.m., Israeli forces have carried out a large-scale incursion across the Tubas governorate.
blocking entrances with armored vehicles, and roadblocks. Local officials say Israel's claim of targeting armed groups is a pretext to advance its annexation plans, especially after the recent seizure of over 1,000 dunams of land. Emergency teams are responding to residents and coordinating medical evacuations with the Red Cross, while authorities warn the situation is dire and amounts to collective punishment in violation of international law.
Since early Wednesday morning, Israeli forces have stormed the entire Tobas governorate and its surrounding towns. All main entrances in and out of the area have been closed, along with roads leading to agricultural lands. Several families were also forced out of their homes, and their dwellings were turned into military posts. The operation continues, with movement restrictions and harassment.
Israeli forces have been trying to amplify the scene with repeated raids. However, on the ground, indicators suggest there is no real military objective. The operation has only resulted in arrests of civilians, turning homes into military barracks, field interrogations, and attacks on residents.
Israeli soldiers stormed my home without waiting for me to open the door. They damaged house utensils and physically assaulted me. They then arrested my son. In a previous raid, they also turned my home into a military barrack for 10 days.
We received alerts about medical cases in the town of Tamun. At the first checkpoint, we were stopped and prevented from entering. We then had to coordinate so that one ambulance could meet us before the checkpoint and another after it. Because of this delay and the searches, we arrived late to the patients.
The aggression, which Israel claims is a military operation, is seemingly an extension of a process linked to the recent land grab in the northern Jordan Valley. This reflects Israel's intent to isolate the Tobas governorate from the Jordan Valley, with a barrier separating the city from the surrounding area.
The Israeli army launched the wide-scale military operation early on Wednesday in the northern West Bank city of Tobas, carrying out extensive raids and breaking into homes. Residents say Israel's claim of dismantling the so-called armed groups is merely an excuse to justify escalating pressure on Palestinians as these operations continue to expand and tighten control across the West Bank. Tiba Asi, Occupy Tobas.
Italy has expelled an Egyptian imam simply for having described the Al-Aqsa flood operation as an act of resistance by the Palestinians. The imam is a man with a clean record who has been living in Italy for the past 20 years.
The rule of law is under serious attack in Italy and in the rest of the European Union as arrests and expulsions for thought crimes have continued incessantly. Earlier this week, the Italian authorities arrested Mohamed Shaheen for his remarks made last month during a rally in solidarity with the Palestinians, when he described the Al-Aqsa flood operation as an act of resistance after years of occupation. Shaheen is an imam from Italy's northern city of Turin, and the Italian government intends to expel him on security grounds.
This affair is seemingly a considerable regression of rights in Italy. However, let's wait until the court makes a decision on the government's expulsion decree. Obviously, the Italian executive is following in the Trump administration's footsteps.
Mohamed Shaheen is a 46-year-old imam of Egyptian nationality with a spotless record. He was arrested on Tuesday for expressing his support to the besieged Palestinians. Shaheen has two kids and has been living in Turin for 20 years. He is currently detained in a repatriation center in faraway Sicily. Shaheen is a dissident cleric who has a record of speaking out against Egyptian authorities, and his life would be at risk if extradited to Egypt, according to his lawyer.
Shaheen has been detained for simply saying that we cannot isolate October 7th from the decades of siege, occupation that preceded it. He's always been against all forms of violence, and now risks losing everything he has if he is transferred to an Egyptian prison. There has been a repressive turn in the Italian government's approach to security following the many protests in solidarity with the Palestinians held in the country.
Islamophobia and the criminalization of the Muslim communities go away and come back in tides in Italy. We are often targeted by national and local governments with ad hoc measures aiming to shut down or increase controls on Islamic centers, although Muslims are very peaceful. The atmosphere has changed over the past years. It's quite gloomy.
Even the recent announcement of the creation of a new Muslim association aspiring to become a political party has caused a stir in Italy. In other EU countries like France and Germany, it is illegal to express views which include some forms of criticism of Israel. Italy is discussing a similar bill presented by the Giorgia Meloni right-wing government in August. Max Civili, Rome.
At least two U.S. National Guard members have been shot in an attack near the White House and are in critical condition. According to security sources, the injured National Guard members exchanged fire with the suspected shooter before being shot. The sources said the suspect was detained and taken from the scene on a stretcher. They added that the suspect was shot and wounded by law enforcement, and his motive is under investigation. Following the incident, President Donald Trump requested 500 additional National Guard troops to be sent to Washington, D.C., reacting to the incident in a social media post. Trump confirmed that the shooter was severely wounded, vowing he will pay a very steep price. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Reporters. Thanks to Trump, European Commission insiders say an atmosphere of fear and uncertainty continues to hang over EU-US trade relations. Meeting on Monday, EU trade ministers agreed the bloc must broaden its commercial horizons and seek additional stable partners.
What we are working on continuously, that we have to diversify our trade. The Commissioner gave us a state on ongoing negotiations with India and a number of other countries and regions in Asia, Middle East and Africa.
It emerged at Monday's meeting, attended by senior White House officials, that the EU has already paid €173 billion for US energy imports this year, much of it for costly liquefied natural gas shipped across the Atlantic. Those charges filter through industry and ultimately onto consumers. It's a stark contrast to the much cheaper Russian gas that once powered the EU.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, struck a deal with Trump at his golf course in Scotland last July. He had been threatening 50% US tariffs on all EU imports, but in the end they settled on a baseline 15% levy. Now Washington officials are annoyed at the EU over its slow implementation of that deal.
Punishing 50% US tariffs on EU steel and aluminium remain firmly in place. The current trade arrangements have drawn sharp criticism from inside the European Parliament.
Trump is the worst bully in the schoolyard. He picks on everyone. You should never give in to blackmail. The more money we promise to pour into the US, the more they will demand from us.
EU citizens are equally scathing of the current US administration.
I think it's just right now a pause maybe before, I know, like maybe then Trump decides to impose tariffs again or to increase them on us. And plus right now with the Ukraine plan, again, like the recently disclosed Ukraine plan, is going to be other tensions as well.
If Vance is taking the place of Trump because he's talking about that now, I think it's even more dangerous. And in a way, even if they go back and they will be less rude in a few years, I think the tune is set, if we can say this in English. I think it's very dangerous. Yeah, I think so.
Government leaders are being accused of surrendering far too much ground to Trump on trade, leaving millions of already struggling EU businesses and households to shoulder the cost. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Italian prosecutors will have to decide whether to put the suspects, who today are between 65 and 80 years old, on trial. They are suspected of voluntary murder aggravated by cruelty and abject motives, a crime which has no statute of limitations and carries a maximum life sentence. Some political analysts believe that the whole Sarajevo sniper tourism affair can also be read through the lens of geopolitics. They suspect that there are governments who are trying to link Serbian President Aleksandar Vučić to the so-called sniper safaris that took place in Bosnia in the 1990s.
The risk that this affair is turned into a political tool clearly exists. Some may be eager to find political implications in these murders, but they would be wrong. Those were just criminal acts.
I think it could well be politicized because the information that we have at the moment is very murky indeed, and no concrete details are being given as to what is actually being investigated. Neither the numbers, nor the people involved, nor the countries involved.
During the Rome press conference, Gavazzeni also pointed out that Italy's military intelligence agency was aware of the abominable trips when they took place, but nothing was done to stop them. Max Civili, Rome.
Next to the conscientious objector's commemorative stone, a demonstration rooted in conscience. Demonstrators, some from other parts of Europe, defying the elements and threats of arrest, holding placards that have become symbols of nonviolent action.
What people here are doing, and what the widespread wave of civil disobedience that we've started with Defend Our Juries, is against the prescription of Palestine Action. And that prescription, which is now being challenged in the High Court next week, is basically what we're arguing, that it is unjust, it's immoral, and it should have never happened. And it is really a breach of everyone's civil liberties. It is really an attack on democracy.
Before long come the arrests. Since these protests first began in the summer, British police have arrested more than 2,000, charging hundreds under terror laws in a move the demonstrators say is to stifle dissent against the UK's complicity in Israel's genocidal war on Palestinians.
They've attempted to use terrorism legislation to remove from all public discourse the one body of people in this country who, as citizens, have stood up and put their bodies on the line to materially interrupt an economic, military, and diplomatic collaboration in genocide.
Palestine Action was prescribed by former Home Secretary Yvette Cooper in June this year. Membership of or support for the group is punishable by up to 14 years in prison.
The government is complicit in the genocide in Gaza, and they will do anything to criminalize any resistance against it, including old people sat with signs saying, "I oppose genocide."
In an unprecedented move in British history, Palestine Action is challenging its prescription in this court starting November 25th in the form of a judicial review.
If the High Court votes in favor of Palestine Action, the thousands of arrests and the hundreds of charges that were brought against demonstrators like these under the Terrorism Act of 2000 will also be quashed.
A victory for Palestine Action would also have repercussions for its jailed members, six of whom are now on an open-ended hunger strike in prisons across Britain. Cyprus, London.
Israel has struck a residential building in the heart of the Beirut suburbs. The third and fourth floors of a nine-story building were badly damaged, with debris filling the road, damaging cars and property. Deputy head of Hezbollah Political Bureau confirmed to Press TV that a senior commander was targeted in the strike.
This is an attempted assassination, targeting a key leader within the resistance. What matters now is that we document this as a clear act of aggression, an escalation we cannot and will not tolerate. It is our responsibility at the national level to establish a response that confronts Israel's attempt to undermine our sovereignty.
Although the Israeli statement said the target was a commander in the resistance, people near the scene say Israeli strikes are targeting everyone.
I am from this neighborhood. Every time they come up with this claim that they are targeting a member of the resistance, we are all members of the resistance. I want to tell our prime minister, who was a judge in the international court, if your diplomacy can't protect us and solve our crisis, then leave us to be and don't speak in our name. And this mechanism is obviously biased towards Israel.
Alice believes the Israeli claims that Hezbollah has rehabilitated is merely preparing the ground for a larger escalation and a U.S. green light for this aggression.
This marks a new level of violation, and there are two potential outcomes. Either the resistance retaliates, which would escalate into a full-scale war, or they absorb this blow, which could embolden Israel to carry out further strikes. Both options are devastating. This is a turning point. With Israel seeking to normalize its escalation in Lebanon, backed by U.S. support, and with the Lebanese government failing to take action.
President Joseph Aoun called on the international community to intervene firmly to stop Israeli attacks on the country. Lebanon, he said, reiterates its call to the international community to assume its responsibility and intervene firmly and seriously to stop the attacks on Lebanon and its people. The Israeli strike on the southern suburbs of Beirut and the U.S. blessing are considered part of the growing pressure by both sides to enforce full surrender by Hezbollah and full compliance of the Lebanese government to disarm the resistance. However, many believe that this opens the way for different scenarios, especially if the resistance decides it is time to retaliate. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
In September this year, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced his government's plans to introduce mandatory digital ID for all British citizens by 2029. The announcement sparked fury across the full spectrum of the British political landscape, uniting forces who would otherwise disagree on pretty much everything else. The digital ID's plans have led to continuous protests, with thousands braving wintry weather conditions in London on Saturday to express their opposition to the plans.
We're here to protest digital ID. We're also here to make the point to people that they're already being tracked, they're already being surveilled and controlled by systems beyond their knowledge or control. And this is just an extra step. And this is almost a way for the government to act like we're giving our consent for them to track us. But they're doing it anyway.
Today, the main justification given by Starmer for the rollout of digital IDs is to help the government's crackdown on illegal migration, leading to suspicions that the so-called migrant crisis was allowed to develop to then justify these types of draconian measures in response.
A massive fear that many Brits have is that the digital ID plans, in combination with a rumoured ban on the use of cash in the future, portends the creation of a dystopian AI-powered control grid where every move you make is subject to surveillance and censorship by the state in real time.
These protesters believe that enough of the country is opposed to the digital ID rollout, but that for mass non-compliance to become a realistic prospect, unity across the political spectrum is a must.
Anybody organising anything can be controlled by this. So we want everyone to unite in common cause. As you say on our leaflet here, Palestine and freedom fighters, indeed everyone, unite in common cause.
The British state has long wanted to introduce digital IDs, going as far back as when Tony Blair floated the prospect when he was Prime Minister in the 2000s. But with mass opposition already forming and one of the most unpopular governments in recent history at the helm, a opponents are quietly confident in their chances of defeating the entire idea altogether. Peace Academy, London.
Yemen's health minister Ali Shaiban paints a stark picture of a health system suffocating under siege. Medicines are vanishing, chronic patients are deteriorating, children are dying before help can reach them. He called the shutdown of Sana'a International Airport a crime against humanity, especially after Israeli strikes destroyed its capacity, cutting off the only viable route for life-saving drugs. Families now face a brutal reality. No airport means no treatment, and no treatment means lives lost.
Today, we renew our call for the United Nations to operate flights and reopen Sana'a International Airport to save thousands of patients who urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. More than 250,000 patients require medical travel for serious and life-threatening conditions. Over 1,330 types of essential medicines, including immune therapies and other critical drugs, have not been allowed into the country due to the air blockade.
The ministry says thousands have been deprived of essential medications due to the air blockade. It warns that inaction would cause more deaths that can be simply prevented.
The continued closure of Sana'a International Airport clearly proves that the international humanitarian and health organizations that constantly preach about human rights are fully politicized and operate under American and Israeli influence. The clearest example is what is happening in Yemen, where thousands of people urgently need to travel for treatment but remain unable to do so as the airport remains closed to this moment.
Israel struck Sana'a International Airport in early May this year, damaging its runway, terminal, and several aircraft. The regime struck the facility again as Yemen continued its military operations against Israeli targets in response to its war on Gaza. Yemen's health ministry says the reopening of the airport, once a lifeline for the population, is an urgent humanitarian obligation, not a political convenience.
The health crisis continues to escalate as life-saving medicines remain blocked from entering the country. Officials warn that unless urgent steps are taken to restore medical access, thousands of vulnerable patients will face worsening conditions with no alternative options. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The streets of Tehran turning into rivers of remembrance. Coffins draped in flowers and the Iranian tricolor moving slowly from the main gate of Tehran University along major avenues towards the martyrs' memorial. Thousands lining the route, reciting prayers and chanting tributes for the fallen. The ceremony marking National Day of Unknown Soldiers honors fighters whose remains were recovered decades after the Iraqi-imposed war. Their sacrifice, officials say, remains the backbone of Iran's security.
You should not think they have died. According to Islamic teaching, they are alive with God. We are here to let these unknown soldiers know we remember them and are grateful for their sacrifice.
Among the crowd are veterans, families of martyrs, school children, and young volunteers, generations connected through shared memory and devotion to their homeland.
They sacrificed their lives for our homeland. That is the ultimate act of faith and love for the nation.
The unity of the people is what the martyrs expect from us, not distraction or division.
We are just like their families. We are here for them. I lost my own family, all martyred in the war, so I feel like a sister, a mother, to these unknown martyrs.
While huge crowds escort 100 martyrs to their final resting place, even more have converged on Imam Hussein Square for a special ritual marking the martyrdom anniversary of Lady Fatima Zahra, the daughter of the Prophet of Islam. Here, massive cauldrons of samanu, a sweet paste made from wheat germ, are stirred in turn by volunteers. This is more than a religious ritual. It is an act that fosters empathy and solidarity.
Everyone you see here has come out of love for our beloved lady. So as you can see, honoring martyrs is rooted in our culture, a tradition that never fades.
Two scenes, one spirit. Iran's culture of remembrance transforming grief into faith. From Samanu offerings in Imam Hussein Square to salutes before the coffins of the unknown soldiers.
As Iranians bid farewell to these unknown martyrs, the participants say the sacrifice of these fallen soldiers is the foundation of Iran's unity, resilience, and security. Yusuf Shahmadi, Tehran.
Trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Is there any way left to save me? I need someone from heaven. You can heal my soul and not just my body. I need someone from heaven. You can make me free and not just happy. Today is over and I'm alone again. You show me a new movie, but then everything's the same. You give me small pills and push me to sleep, but you can't change my dreams, they're too deep. You think you know everything, you think you're enough, but sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. Is there anywhere left to save me? I'm inside.
چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. This is a short part of Imam Khomeini's viewpoints on results and outcomes of the uprising of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, peace be upon him. The innocent, infallible Imams, peace be upon them all were killed, but their ideological school remained intact. The master of martyrs was killed, his ideology survived, rather revived, by his getting killed, his ideology remained safe. Similarly, divine authorities, most of them were defeated, but their ideology survived. The Master of Martyrs, together with his kin and disciples, were all massacred, but they advanced their ideology.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Dear audience, welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. About the subject of Muharram and Ashura, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said, "Lamentations for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, keeping the movement alive and maintaining alive the fact that a small number of people successfully stood up against a great empire are orders of the day." Here, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi emphasizes the significance of standing against tyranny, even though the truth seekers be members of minority. When Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam started his revolution, he was aware of the consequences of his movements, you know. He was an infallible imam. Infallible imams' extensive knowledge and insights are beyond our heads. Imam Hussein alayhi salam revolted to set a role model, and he refused to surrender. He asked people to help him, and when a group of people from Kufa expressed their willingness to accompany him on his path, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam accepted their offer and moved towards Kufa, and he did not give up in the middle of the way. Imam Hussein alayhi salam stood up against the deviated current of his time, which was extremely dangerous, and this became a lesson, and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam himself makes the same point. That is to say, he backed up his action with the order of Islam. He said that his duty was what he was doing. He said that he had to express his opposition no matter what the consequences were. He said, "It is good if my destiny is a victory, and if my destiny is martyrdom, so much the better." This was a perfect instance of self-sacrifice and safeguarding Islam. If Imam Hussein alayhi salam had not accepted this danger, if he had not made a move, if he had not taken action, if his blood had not been shed, this event would not have gone down in history. The event that could have prevented that great deviation had to shock people in history as much as the deviation did. This shows Imam Hussein's self-sacrifice, and we should really take lessons out of these. And this is what Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi emphasized in this regard. Thank you very much for listening to us, and until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum.
Welcome, kids.
Hey, man.
Hey, girl.
Hello.
Hi.
My brothers, my sisters, and all of my gentle friends, this is a song that I have learned. Let's sing it.
Welcome to
the
Kids
end.
Corner.
And you know, you're not gonna go wrong when you're at Kids Corner.
We say assalamu alaikum, wa alaikum assalam.
Assalamu alaikum, dude.
Assalamu alaikum, wa alaikum assalam.
You're listening to Brother Ali at Kids Corner. Are you ready?
Yes.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay?
Okay.
Are you guys with me?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Good job, mashallah. You guys are doing it. Ah, good question. Good question. I'm about to answer that question. Kids Corner. A'udhu billahi minash shaitani rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa alihi tayyibin at-tahirin.
Allahumma
salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. Welcome, dear listeners.
Hello.
Hi.
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
You're listening to Brother Ali at Kids
Corner.
Yeehaw!
Welcome, everyone.
Assalamu alaikum. Assalamu alaikum. Wa alaikum assalam. Wa alaikum assalam. Come to the masjid, come to the masjid. Wash and pray, wash and pray. These are the things that will keep the devil away.
We were talking about sitting etiquette in the last few sessions, actually, huh? Okay, in the last session, I don't know if you guys remember, what did we talk about in the last session? Okay, how about this? I'll remind you. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, do not hasten to occupy the highest spot in the assembly, for a seat which you are promoted to is better than one you're demoted to. You guys understand the saying?
Yes.
Can you really quick explain?
It means that, for example, we go sit somewhere, and then the host of that gathering, he says, this is reserved for someone else, so please go sit there. So that seat, we were sitting in this
important place.
Important place, and then we're
demoted to
a normal place.
Very good.
So that place is worse.
Like this guy comes in, he goes, you know what, I'm a big guy, yeah. I'm going to go and sit at that important place. He goes and sits there, and the host says, excuse me, hello, can you hear me? Okay, can you move, please? Can you go to the other place? Huh? And this guy's like, oh, okay, and he goes to the ordinary place, right? Now he's getting demoted to, right? We talked about that. All right, Imam Hassan Askari alayhi salam said, the one who is satisfied with the place where he's sitting, but he deserves to be sitting at a better place than what? Do you remember?
Allah and the angels are blessing him the whole time.
All right, good job.
Way to go!
Allah, subhanahu wa ta'ala, and the angels are blessing this person as long as he sits there. You know why? Because he deserves to be sitting at one better place, and he chose an ordinary place. Okay, now we're going to talk about with whom must we sit. We talked about gatherings. Now, there's a saying of Imam Ali alayhi salam. He says, sit with the poor. Sit with the poor and your gratefulness will increase. What does that mean? Oh, Imam Ali alayhi salam. He said this, sit with the poor and your gratefulness will increase. What does that mean?
It means that if we sit among the poor, we realize how much Allah has given us.
Beautiful.
Yeah. Woohoo! Good
your job, people.
This is so true. When we sit with the poor people, then we will be more grateful for all the blessings that Allah has given us. All right? The poor people live in a very simple life. They lead a very simple life. They eat very simple food. They cannot afford many luxuries. Correct? So when we sit with them, we will realize, oh my God, Allah has given us so much. Then we'll be more grateful. We'll be more thankful for all the blessings that Allah has given us. Okay? Like, for example, you know, you sit with a poor person and you see the bread this person is eating, dry bread. Okay? And we have meat and everything, he's dipping this bread, like, for example, in water and having it. Just bread. You sit with this person, you realize, oh my God, I can't eat that. How is he eating? Huh? I eat, like, with bread kebabs or hamburgers, what have you, huh? And I do it like nothing. No big deal. But then when I look at this person, I realize, oh my God, all these blessings that Allah has given us. As an example, okay? Now, there's another saying of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. He said, feign poverty and love the poor. Sit with them and help them and shun the companionship of the rich. And be kind to them and covet not their wealth. Okay? What does that mean? The Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi is saying, pretend that you are poor and sit with them and love them. Pretend, feign poverty. Pretend that you're poor and sit with the poor people and love them. Don't, you know, shun them. Love them. And stay away from sitting in the company of the rich. Now, this does not mean that we should be mean to the rich people. That's what the Prophet is saying. Don't be mean to them. Rather, be kind to them. But do not desire their wealth. Don't desire their wealth. So, what do we learn from this hadith, my dear brothers and sisters? Huh? Brother Hashim and Sumayya, tell me. He says, pretend, sit with the poor. And love them and help them and stay away from sitting in the company of the rich. But be kind to the rich, but do not desire their wealth.
So it means that we should be happy with what we have, and we should sit with the poor so that we appreciate it more.
Right. Again, the same. Sit with the poor so we appreciate, we thank Allah. You're grateful to him. Sit with the poor so you realize, you know, the blessings that you have. And love them. Don't be like, because it can happen to anyone. This person is poor today. God forbid we might be poor tomorrow. Okay? It makes us realize a lot of things. And we'll understand the hardships they go through. Sit with them. But don't sit with the rich because a lot of times, not all the time, not a lot of times, the rich, you know, they have the wealth and they are like, God forbid, doing haram and all that. But there are a lot of other rich people too that they don't sin. And it's not that if they're rich that they're definitely sinning. But this is a general idea the Prophet is saying. Some people like, oh, I'm going to be with the rich person. I like to move with the rich people or the important people. I don't stay with the poor people. Prophet says, no, stay with the poor people. Okay? Prophet is saying no otherwise. He says, sit with the poor people and love them. And stay away from the rich. Don't be thinking that, you know, if I'm with the rich, you know, my status is going to be something. No. Stay away. And do not desire their wealth. Some people, when they're with the rich, oh my God, look at the car that he has. Oh my God, look at that big house he has. I want that. Oh, I want this, that. You know, they start desiring. Prophet says don't desire their wealth.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all.
It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Okay, I got another saying of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. The disciples said to the Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, O Spirit of Allah, with whom must we sit? And Prophet Jesus said, those who remind you of Allah when you look at them, those whose speech increases your knowledge, and whose deeds draw you to the hereafter. Remember something like that? Prophet had also said, a friend should be like this. Prophet Jesus is saying a similar thing. Okay? He said, those who remind you of Allah, when you look at them, when they ask the Prophet, who do we sit with? Prophet Jesus said, those who remind you of Allah, when you look at them, whose speech increases your knowledge, and whose deeds draw you to the hereafter. We talked about this. I'm not going to talk more about this hadith. You guys understand what Prophet Jesus is saying here, right? Okay. Another saying of the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Do not sit, but with every scholar who calls you from five states to five states. This is a little difficult one, and I'll explain you. From doubt to certainty, from hypocrisy to sincerity, from desire to fear, from arrogance to humility, and from deceit to honesty. Prophet is saying, do not sit but with every scholar who calls you from five states to five states. Like, for example, from doubt. Like, for example, I'm doubtful, right? Like, you know what? I don't know if this is true. Are we really supposed to? Does Allah really exist? Doubt. Mm. Right? So if I should not sit with a person who is going to increase our doubts. Mm-hmm. You know, if I go and the person says, you know what, about the salat, you know, that we prayed five times a day, I really doubt it. There's nothing in the Quran that says we're supposed to pray three rakat for Maghrib and four rakat for Dhuhr. You know, he puts a doubt in your mind. He says, don't sit with that kind of person who puts doubts in your mind. Sit with a person that will increase your yaqeen, your certainty. All right, you guys understand this? Is it too hard for you? Kinda?
No, it's easy.
Is it okay?
Yeah.
All right. And from hypocrisy, a person that... who calls you from five states, a person who calls you from hypocrisy to sincerity. Okay. Sit with a person, like for example, God forbid, you have nifaq in you, like hypocrisy, like for example, you say something and you do something, something else. This person says, you know what, don't do this, this is haram, this is not good, this is hypocrisy. Whatever you say, do it. Okay? Or whatever you believe in, do it. Okay, you believe in something and you're doing something else. Like the hypocrites at the time of the Holy Prophet, they used to pray, they used to do all kinds of things, everything, and they come to the masjid, they come for Jamaat and Salatul Jummah and everything. But their plans were something, they believed in something else. They had plans, they had evil plans, and they were hypocrites. So a scholar who takes you from hypocrisy to sincerity, sit with him. Okay? Don't sit with the person that, you know, he will make you a hypocrite. Don't sit with that person. And from deceit to honesty. From, you know, another point is you sit with a scholar who is taking you, from the path of deceit to honesty. He's making you more honest. Like, for example, you're not true to your words and all that. And he says, no, this is haram, don't do this, do this. Okay, that kind of stuff. All right,